mayor's work group on preventing violence is set to have its first meeting.
Yeah.
I talked with U of L adjunct professor Stacey Brooks, along with task force members Neil Robertson and health department director Dr. Laquandra Nesbitt, about what the panel hopes to accomplish.
We had actually started back in February or March, at least through my department, trying to look at what our capacity more broadly was around injury and violence prevention. And it started to work with LMPD, the health department, and the Office of Youth Development and Community Services and Revitalization, just thinking about what resources we have and how we can have an approach to injury and violence prevention that's not rooted in the criminal justice system.
Because people think of homicide, they usually don't think of health, they think of criminal justice.
They do not. They think of a criminal justice perspective of it. But if you think about the social well-being and the behavioral health needs of a community that is experiencing homicide at a disproportionate level. So what is it that goes on in the mind of an individual that whatever age they are, they have not appreciated the value of the person in front of them in terms of their life, and they commit a homicide. So those are the types of issues that we look at, and we know that those same behaviors are linked to poor health outcomes. If those individuals do live to older ages, they're more likely to have chronic disease. They're more likely to have emotional and mood disorders rooted in stress and depression. They tend to be high costs to the healthcare system. So all of these things make it a public health issue. And not to mention the gun violence people who don't die. Right.
If you want to think about it,
exactly. And the physical disabilities that may ensue. So there's a host of different other issues that when we're looking at it from a prevention perspective, we can't just start with a criminal justice approach to violence prevention.
Now, Neil, you're on this work group as well. Now, one of your points, I think, consistently when we met before, when the work group was before members were actually named to it, you had made the point that, you know, not everyone can connect with a Dr. Blaine Hudson or Kevin Cosby or et cetera. You being on the work group and others who are sort of more at the community level, do you think that that will help engender some, I guess, trust and respect among the group?
Well, what I meant by that, I meant that they're not, Reverend Cosby, Dr. Blaine Hudson, they're not really in that community.
But they live in West Louisville, though.
Yeah, absolutely, but they don't live on 32nd Street. And not saying that I do neither, but I've lived in the projects. I came up in the project. And like Dr. Nesbitt was talking about, some of the things that you go through, you know, when you're living in the projects and you're seeing some of the things, not from the medical point that she was bringing up, but just from being there. Like, I don't know if Dr. Hudson or Dr. Wayne Cosby came up without a father. I don't know if they came up having to wake up to see if they have something to eat the next day.
So the experiential knowledge to you is just as important as anything else.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
But in that regard, what is it that you want the work group to accomplish then? Because that sounds to me that there's never going to be enough spaces for everyone. I mean, already we've heard people criticize, the work group's too small, it's too little, I don't see enough, this particular person on it. I mean, that just comes with a political, I guess, argument with a mayor appointing a work group in the first place. But can we have everyone be on the work group itself? I mean, won't those be on committees or subcommittees?
I mean, I'm sure everybody will have something to bring to the table, but what I need them to really try to understand is the fact that we have to try to see about providing jobs, better education for people that's really not being able to receive it based on for whatever reason, you know. I mean, because when I was coming up, you know, and that's been many years ago, but things really haven't never changed. And me and Dr. Nebson was talking before we came on air, and was talking about the fact that, I mean, I don't know if their eyes were open when I was riding past 32nd Street or any other street, Victory Park or any other crime-infested area, seeing the names already on the windows, on the walls, rest in peace, the shrines that's already been up. And, you know, I just feel that these people don't really have, like, job opportunities, educational opportunities, and they get left behind, and they have to eat some kind of way.
Professor Brooks, is that the issue, that we don't have enough people who have experienced the violence on the panel? You're someone who's on the outside looking in.
I don't know if that's the issue or not, but I know that when a place has a reputation, the reputation of the place then drives the narrative about what people speculate about as to what happened. But there's no doubt that, you know, the things that Neil was mentioning are pertinent issues, you know, people being employed to the point where they can pay their bills and live comfortably and think about a future for their children. the issues of equitable education and everybody feeling like their education has meaningful ways of translating into success in society. The environment itself. I mean, I don't know if we've done walkability studies of West Louisville and things like that, but the whole idea of a place being comfortable and cultivating growth in livelihood and happiness is what we're talking
about. So it's not
about
a particular incident anymore?
No.
No, I mean, it hasn't been about the particular incident since, you know, people found, you know, since all the dust settled and we knew how many people lived and who died and things like that. You know, some people followed the particulars of the story, but the main general overview was multiple homicide in West Louisville. And then...
Because since then you've had, I mean, 15-year-old Tisha Spearman, the junior at Shawnee High School, was shot and killed. I mean, so we can't get caught up in necessarily the each individual case.
We can, but we tend not to, because we're talking about something that's occurring in a place that has historical discrepancies when it comes to education, when it comes to economic viability. You can go on, you know, we're talking about health concerns, the fast food versus the fresh produce. Like, all of these things are built into the history of the West Louisville anyway. So when something like that occurs within this area and it's Black people involved, the narrative, the grand narrative, begins to overshadow the particular instance in each case.
Are you confident that the mayor's work group will get anything done?
No, I'm not confident that they'll get anything done at all. I mean, it's a lot of people who probably have great insight into the problem, but it's not the issue with West Louisville is not we don't have the expertise to figure out what's going on. Is we don't have the political will or wherewithal to do the things that are necessary to change the situation.
I mean, I have to go back to what Dr. Nesbitt said about the mental health side. When you stated that the young lady had a job, right? Maybe she was just seeing so much violence around her.
Maybe because she was dating a drug dealer.
Well, I don't know if he was a drug dealer or not. I mean, you know, maybe I didn't read anything concerning, you know, what that man did or whatever. I don't even know which one she dated, but it was just surrounding her all times. And it's back to what this gentleman was saying. I forgot your name, brother. You know, we're going to do as much as we can do, but it's not going to be really even up to us. It's going to be up to the people in the community.
One of the first conversations I had with Blaine Hudson, the chair of the group, when we were first announcing that he was going to be the chair of this work group, and he has been, any report that you look at historically that's been done on looking at the African-American community, looking at West Louisville geographically, what have you, over the past 15 to 20 years, he has somehow influenced or been involved. You've done this before and you have this perspective, or you've had this experience that sometimes all of these people come together, be it either for 3 months or 3 years, and they publish these documents full of recommendations and they sit on the shelf. If I were Dr. Blaine Hudson, who is the dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at U of L, who undoubtedly is a very busy guy in high demand running Saturday Academy and a host of other things, I've got to make a very conscious decision as to whether or not I think doing this is a good use of my time, right? And from his perspective, or the comment he made to me was, this is the first time, yes, this is the first time that the executive leadership of our city has asked for this.
It's always been an outside group.
Exactly. And so I think that is what gives this potential an opportunity.
Now, Neil, you were talking about people being in the community. When I talked to Dr. Hudson, he was saying this is something that's going to have to expand outside of West Louisville, outside of the quote-unquote Black community. But if we look at the statistics, and you know, correct me if I'm wrong, which I'm sure this panel will, but we look at the number of homicides, 22 homicides in Louisville thus far. I believe approximately 15 or so are African-American. And those homicides are occurring west of 9th Street. For outsiders, the question is, what's wrong with African-Americans in West Louisville? How do you respond to that?
Well, I was watching the news the night, the third day of the homicides that happened on 32nd Street. And they interviewed a young lady from St. Matthews. And she couldn't even understand it. Was trying to figure out, why is all this happening in West Louisville? And I'm looking at the news and I'm talking to myself. Not literally talking to myself, but I'm thinking to myself, yeah, you wouldn't have a clue of what's really happening.
But the narrative and what's being thrown out by the leadership is that, well, it's her problem too. Well, is it her problem too? I mean, how is it? She lives on the other side of town.
I mean, yes, but no. Yes, yes, I'm saying yes,
yeah,
but no.
I think it's absolutely her problem, too. Yeah. And it's her problem from a number of perspectives. If you look at what gets put out, on, if you're talking about national statistics, right, and Louisville likes to make the claim of being one of the large cities. And when you look at large cities, you don't look at what section of this large city has a crime problem. It gets reported as this large city has a crime problem. They have a homicide issue. It doesn't separate for the people who do not live here. It doesn't separate from 9th Street, East and West. What that means is that if I'm a business owner or if I'm a young, educated person moving here wanting to work, if I am a person who grew up here wanting to stay, I need to believe that the city that I am a member of or resident of has great potential because it has a great reputation. So it becomes her problem from an economic development perspective and the opportunities afforded to her. Nonetheless, it becomes her problem because if we have a problem where African Americans continue to be disproportionately impacted by crime, that means that they are not excelling in the community in the way that other racial and ethnic groups are, and now we've got a diversity and inclusion problem.
Now, what black folks,
and I think that's an issue.
But what black folks around here often say, Stacey, is that, listen, if you're not involved in crime, if you stay out of it, you really don't get involved. You don't get killed. I mean, I know you were talking about earlier the individuals who were involved in the case in May, but those individuals did have a criminal background, criminal history. It's not like random people in West Louisville are being murdered. People are really good at isolating the problem, saying that's not my problem. I can put it to this particular group. How can, because it seems like a large part of what this work group is about is reaching out to people who say it's not my problem. How do we translate to those folks who say, well, as long as I'm not involved in criminal activity, it's not my problem?
A lot of people, I mean, you know, I know, and I cringe at the idea that people could be so dismissive of those issues.
But they are.
But they are. And people abstract. That's where the crime is. The crime is in that area amongst those people, those types, or whether it's this time of day or this time of the evening, among these types of activities. And they disassociate themselves with those problems, especially from their perspective. If they're looking in St. Matthews, for instance, there is no economic depravity in St. Matthews. There are options. There is a positive outlook on what and how what their schools are at least telling them about themselves in those schools and how they project them out to the wider world. So although people that know that there is this connectiveness in society and that schools not being equitable affect our society as a whole and that one area's economic depravity does affect the larger economic picture, those individuals still need to be convinced that those problems affect them. That's why you have so many people that are able to kind of dissociate.
So we need people to buy into the idea. Outside the community to buy into it in order for it to work?
Well, they should, but how many people really that live out St. Matthew or east of 9th Street or east of the Berlin Wall, as they call it, really are say to themselves, let's take a drive. Let's ride down the West End.
But even people in West Louisville. I mean, in West Louisville, the conversation is, well, you know, I live in Chickasaw, and I do. I don't live in Parkland. Well, those black people. You know, those black people who come from single-parent homes, who are on welfare, who live in the projects, that's not me. I mean, even within the West End, we have people who sort of disassociate themselves from it and say that's their problem. In fact, we'll say they deserve to have that happen to them.
Yeah, but look how close that is.
Stacey, for those who are not on the work group who may be watching this even if, as just as spectators, but those who actually are trying to get involved, this is an unprecedented attention to violence in Louisville. Is there anything that outsiders have to add to this perspective, whether they get involved with the subcommittees or not, whether they maybe start, you know, I've seen Councilwoman Attica Scott and others sort of start these sort of short-term initiatives to deal with the immediate issues of some of the killings and violence. What are their options at this point?
Well, I think that, you know, patient observers, agitators when necessary. I want Dr. Nesbitt to know that I fall in the camp of people that hopes that they're wrong about their ideas about what's actually going to happen and that some things, you know, change our perspectives about what to expect from when, you know, large groups of titled individuals get together to solve a problem in, a disenfranchised community. I hope that I'm wrong about that, and I hope that we see some dynamic initiative taken on the issues that are facing West Louisville. But for those people that are watching, to not to not to be so antsy and to jump into, I guess, you know, for better lack of phrase, partisan perspectives on how to think about what the work group is doing, and everybody to kind of at least start with like a good faith perspective on what's supposed to be happening and what should be going on.
Well, thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For our Defining Fairness series, WFPL producer Laura Ellis and I talked to many in the LGBT community about their experiences, and the diverse story sparked an immediate reaction.
I mean, it kind of became its own, it took on a life of its own, I would say. And I think when we started, we had no idea what it was, we wouldn't have been able to guess how it actually turned out.
Yeah, I didn't, now that you mentioned that, I mean, when I initially started, I was thinking, you know, we were going to get into some really political issues, or, mm-hmm. you know, it was going to be like people telling their war stories, sorts about they got kicked out of their home. But there was some funny stories.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that was the part about it that was interesting to me, that it was apolitical. And I'm usually someone who doesn't like apolitical.
Mm-hmm.
But in this instance, I enjoyed apolitical quite thoroughly.
It was very personal. And the things that people were willing to talk about, I was surprised at, you know, how they told their personal stories and they talked about their feelings, and it wasn't just I believe in this policy or I believe that the money
very little
should go
of that.
To this.
Yeah.
Right. That didn't end up being what was important at all.
Yeah, very. I mean, who's your favorite?
Oh, I don't know if I can say my favorite.
You don't want to be biased to them on.
No, I don't want to be biased, but I mean, I definitely had some moments that really are still sticking with me, like, wow, when she said that, it really blew my mind. For example, Amanda Staal, when she said, you know, we always talk race is a social construct, gender is a social construct, well, disability is also a social construct. I was like, what? Oh my gosh, you're right. Like, it was one of those moments where...
Yeah, because that was something I don't think any local media, I don't know local media has done, I'm not sure about national, the issue of balancing one's sexual orientation, gender identity with their physical identity itself. I think it's safe to say that that was the one that made me feel most uncomfortable. In the sense of, it was this automatic sense, when you see someone who's physically disabled, you want to help them, or you feel bad for them, or feel sorry for them.
Mm-hmm.
But Amanda completely turned that off. She was like,
oh,
no.
Yeah.
In fact, I like being this way.
Mm-hmm.
I like the way I am. I wouldn't take a magic pill to change that. I'm completely okay with who I am. Which made it seem like then that her, any sort of criticism or discrimination she would face as a result of her sexual orientation would be an afterthought.
Right.
Because that's the last thing you probably think of when you meet her.
Right. And we talked about that in a few of the interviews, that your visual identity trumps everything else.
Yeah.
So, like, I think it was Jason Gardner who said, well, when I walk into a room, people see that I'm a black man.
Mm-hmm.
They don't see that I'm gay. They don't even guess that I'm gay usually. You know, they, and I think he said, what his quote was, they think, is he here to rob us? I'm like, wow.
Yeah, if you know Jason, there's the last thing he's going to do.
Right. All right. I couldn't imagine it. But, you know, and like Walter Walker said, you know, I'm at the gay bar because I'm a black man. They think that they can pay to have sex with me.
Yeah, there's this fetish.
It's the visual identity that people perceive first. And then whatever they go on to learn about you later is just icing on the cake, I guess.
Now, Laura, you and I both know, working here, there are folks, and I'm not sure if we've gotten, I haven't read the complaints, if there have been any, but folks will say, well, isn't this simply you aligning yourself, not being objective, aligning yourself with the LGBT movement?
Right. I guess to that I would say that we just let them tell their stories. You know what I mean? I guess I could see people making that argument from a certain standpoint, like of who we choose to give airtime to, if that makes sense. Like who we choose to interview. But really, we didn't influence the content of the interviews, so
I mean,
it's hard for me to say.
I shoot back at and punch back at bias bullies. I mean, anytime someone says, well, it's biased, well, of course, we decided at a meeting to do a series on LGBT individuals and the different identities that they have in their own community. Automatically, that is going to, if you're someone who feels that, you know, we shouldn't have marriage equality, we shouldn't have taken away Don't Ask, Don't Tell, that we shouldn't have passed the Fairness Ordinance because it was special rights. Whatever your viewpoint is, you're automatically going to see this series as biased because you see it as telling the story of a particular community in which you feel like has maybe gotten too much attention as of late. So pish-posh, poppycock.
Well, I would say going beyond, you know, because such a big theme in the interviews was going beyond marriage in the military.
Yeah, we did not.
Really, people like are like, that's not my issue. Like, it doesn't matter most of if them I can't get that. Fired.
Most of them
I
said,
can't get a job in the first
I don't
place.
Care about marriage equality. I don't care about gay marriage. I don't care about don't ask, don't tell. I'm not trying to be in the military. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to get married. That was interesting. I mean, and that, I think that very much humanized the conversation, because how many of us who are heterosexual think about marriage?
Right.
We don't. And I think once the majority group has those rights and it's sort of a natural thing that they think about, yeah, they think that the minority group is obsessed. Every member of the minority group is obsessed with the movement. And what we learned is that, no, most people, they get up every day, whether they're LGBT or not, and they think about going to work. They think about what they're going to eat. They think about the person they're interested in, and they keep it moving.
They think about finding a job. They think about paying the bills.
They think about what trashy show to watch.
They think about, you know, in some cases being safe and not putting themselves in danger.
I was going to ask about that. Like, the one thing that I thought was interesting was Bojangles, who was my favorite. I mean,
I really, really loved this interview.
Not because of the series itself, just because I think him in any interview would be interesting. Him in any conversation, I think, is interesting.
He is quite a character.
His voice is great, too. but he talked about, you know, yeah, we have the fairness ordinance in the city, but is it being enforced? He told a story about how he was at a restaurant with his fiance or boyfriend.
Boyfriend at the time.
And he was feeling harassed, and, you know, he called the police. And, you know, the officer, he said, or alleged, told him, well, were you acting out? Were you acting out of accordance? Or
right, maybe you shouldn't have
maybe
been
you shouldn't been so flamboyant so or so overt. Well, I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
I guess not go out to restaurants and be gay.
Right. But eating in restaurants while gay.
Yeah, eating while gay. So that to me was an interesting conversation that we hadn't heard since the passage of the Fairness Ordinance. Local media usually covers it like, oh, we did this great thing. We passed this historic legislation. But no one talks about, I've never seen a story.
Enforcement.
Is that ordinance being enforced?
Right. And he said, you know, he said that he doesn't feel comfortable anywhere in Louisville holding hands with his husband.
Not even in the Highlands, which people think is sort of the liberal sanctuary.
Not even in the Highlands or Clifton or Crescent Hill, whatever. And he said, because he could be a victim of a hate crime, he said, well, you know, you can prosecute on that as a hate crime. And he said, well, that's if I live. So that was another eye-opening moment, I would say.
Can't wait for, can we talk about a documentary on there?
I think we can.
Good, because I just did. I can't wait for a documentary to take shape, and when that comes out, I think that'll be just as interesting. Laura, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Noise and Notes is produced by WFPL. For more information, visit WFPL.org.